Ms. Ostapenko has no challenges remaining.
Welcome to No Challenges Remaining. I'm Ben Rothenberg. On this episode, we are continuing our discussions about the release of the big new movie Challengers, as reviewed in depth on our last episode. And for this episode, we have something very cool this time, an interview with the creator of the story of the movie, screenwriter Justin Karitzkis. Justin was inspired to write Challengers after being struck by one of the most famous and infamous matches in recent tennis history. We get into that inspiration and lots more about adapting the world of tennis for the big screen, including that wonderful detail about the Cincinnati Applebees, during this interview. And I think this interview is actually pretty comfortably spoiler-free for plot details for the movie. So I hope everyone can enjoy it. Here's Justin. I'll start with this. I read an interview you did with Variety. I guess it came out a couple days ago, where you mentioned watching a specific tennis match that inspired you to get started on this screenplay. And I want to know more about that. But I guess also before that, I guess what your relationship was with tennis before that moment of inspiration.
Well, I grew up in a tennis family to some extent because my whole family is from Queens, and they, you know, spent their youth going to the U.S. Open. And so tennis was very big, especially in my mother's side of the family, both as something that they all knew how to do and something that they were big fans of. And so I took tennis lessons as a kid in L.A., where I grew up, and it quickly became clear to me that there was a real ceiling to how good I was ever going to be. You know, I could sort of feel my own mediocrity in a very real, unignorable way. And, you know, tennis makes it really clear just how bad you are very quickly. Mm-hmm. And so I quit when I was a teenager, and then wasn't really a tennis player or a tennis fan for years until I just happened to turn on the US Open in 2018. And it was the match between Serena Williams and Naomi Osaka in the final. And there was this very controversial call that is now quite infamous about Serena Williams receiving coaching from the sidelines. And she got really upset and said, I would never do that. That's not what happened. And me not being a massive tennis fan up until that point, I had never heard that rule. But it immediately struck me as this intensely cinematic situation that you're all alone on one side of the court. And there's this one person in this massive stadium who cares as much about what happens to you out there as you do, but you can't talk to them. And it clicked in my mind, well, what if you really needed to talk about something? And what if it was something deeper than tennis? What if it was something about what was going on in your lives? And what if somehow it involved the person on the other side of the court? I was already sort of thinking about the movie, and then parallel to that, I started watching a lot of tennis at first as research, but then I just became a legitimate tennis obsessive, you know, to the point where it was the only thing that was holding my attention in a real way. It was better than everything I was seeing at the movies and better than anything I was watching on TV. And that's not because movies were bad. It's because tennis is so good. And so I started to ask myself what felt like an existential question, which was, how could I write something that's as good as tennis? And then the second question was, what would make tennis even better? And for me, the answer to the question of what would make tennis better was, well, it would be better if I could know precisely what was at stake for everybody on a real emotional level at every moment in the match. And so that was really where the idea of the film came from, was that sort of desire.
Yeah, I think we mentioned that in the podcast we did, just sort of reviewing the movie came out last week, that was like the stakes. I think it's something you got very clearly right in this movie, and getting the stakes and the escalating stakes for the characters involved that reveal themselves as you go along. And just for tennis players in general, just, you know, having these two players at different stages of their career, this match that means a lot to both of them in different ways, professionally and personally. Yeah, I guess so. When you got into tennis, what were the sort of things you found more absorbing that kept you locked in after that one? Because the Serena Osaka match was a big sort of cultural flashpoint internationally, but it seems like you hung with it through a lot less loud moments in the sports history.
Well, I started to run out of Grand Slams and Masters and, you know, 500s to watch, and that led me to watch Challenger events because that's what was on. And as you know, those are kind of like filmed with one webcam looking thing.
Yep.
But the emotions of the people on the court are still as high as they are in a Grand Slam, because these guys are playing for their lives. You know, maybe nobody's watching, but, or maybe very few people are watching, And maybe they're only playing for a couple $100 or a couple $1,000 if they're lucky. But they're playing as if their careers and their lives are in the balance because they are. And I found that very inspiring and relatable as a person who had been working in theater for a long time, because it's a similar sort of situation where you have a lot of people who are extremely dedicated to their craft, who are operating at a very high level, who are the best in the world, and who are broke, you know, or losing money to do this. And that was a world of sports that I hadn't seen in a film, you know, or I hadn't seen in a, I had seen in boxing films to some extent. You know, there's a few boxing films about the sort of lower circuit, the outer, the outskirts of the sport. But I hadn't seen that in a movie about tennis, certainly. And that felt like a really interesting place for these two guys at opposite ends of their careers to meet.
This might be an sort of a too obvious a question for someone like you, but one of the things we also marveled at in this movie is just the power of things you can do with making up a story, with having an original fictional story and characters that you're creating. Based some real world sort of people you can point to similarities to for sure in their character profiles. But compared to the two other tennis movies that came out, sort of big Hollywood tennis movies the last 8 years or so now, with The Battle of the Sexes and King Richard, which were both sort of biopics essentially of Billy and Richard, and then also kind of telling this historical story and trying to, I think, tell a story I think each of them thought was important culturally or historically in some certain way. You were sort of able to be a lot looser and I think have a lot more fun with your story. And so I guess when you were coming up with inventing this tennis scenario, this tennis world, while still keeping it grounded in some of the actual scenery for sure, and architecture of the real sport, what was that challenge like for you?
Well, there were a lot of the characters are completely fictional, but I was taking a lot from real tennis stories that I was watching and reading about. You know, I mean, one of the biggest inspirations for the movie was reading Andre Agassi's book Open, where he talks about playing a challenger as a guy who had already won a couple slams and had once been, you know, number one in the world, and then he played a challenger in Nevada, I think, to get his mojo back. You know, to start winning again. And he was kind of pushed to do that by his coach, Brad Gilbert, who by chance ended up being our tennis consultant for this movie. So there was a lot of that kind of stuff that happened where, you know, in a sense, this movie wouldn't exist without Brad. And then he ended up being the person training our actors. So there are a lot of things I was taking from the real world, but yeah, I think I was freed from the constraints of a biopic, you know, that I could kind of imagine my way into these people's lives rather than have to be faithful to a reality.
For sure. No, and I think you hit a lot of, we were saying this from last episode too, you can hit a lot more sort of big truths and show a lot more without being bound by the sort of facts and having to keep things strictly as here's what happened. You can go for a lot bigger themes, I think, reveal a lot more in a lot of certain ways. I think you got the opportunity to do that. Not everyone does achieve that, but I think you did
Well,
through
good.
this.
Thank you. I'm really glad to hear that it felt that way.
There's a lot of little catnip for tennis fans in this movie and some Easter eggs and things like that are hidden in there. And one that I know several people have pointed out, a former player, Laura Robson, pointed out pretty quickly when she was, saw, I think, the premiere in London or an early screening in London somewhere, was the detail of the two of the leads going to eat at Applebee's after Cincinnati, which was very much the place to go there. And during that time of era of the tour, for sure, it's no longer there, sadly, but I guess, yeah, how did that specific detail, like, how did you find that? And then how did sort of other little details and other things to make the tour feel authentic come into this screenplay?
Well, that specific thing I have to give credit to the researchers in the art department, because I had just written it as a restaurant, and then one day they came to my office and said, you know, I'd written it as a sort of Applebee's-ish restaurant, but I didn't know that thing about Applebee's. And One day, one of them came to my office and said, "Hey, there's this New York Times article about how everybody in
Yeah.
Cincinnati eats at Applebee's."
Which I wrote, yeah. So I felt
Oh, you
very
did?
attached to that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Amazing.
That was my article. So I felt like someone in the movie had come in contact with that, or we discussed it occasionally on this podcast. Like my longtime
There you
film artist and
go.
I, Courtney, like kind of bonded over when we first met over late night meals at that Applebee's. And so
Perfect.
seeing this big coming together moment in the Applebee's parking lot felt very real.
Yeah, no, and they were like, "Is it weird to set it at Applebee's?" And I was like, "No, that's perfect. We're setting it at
Yeah.
Applebee's." But no, I mean, a lot of that stuff came out of research, and the stuff that is in the script, a lot of it came out of research. But then, one of the amazing things about making a film is that a screenplay becomes a blueprint for hundreds of different people across all these departments to do their jobs every day, and they're taking this thing that you wrote and then filling in all of the detail that's going to end up on screen, all of the visual detail that you don't have space for in a script. There was a deep relationship with me and with Luca and our props guys, Matt Marks and Mike Drury, who are sort of the best in the business of props. We had this amazing day where they do what's called a props show and tell, where the props department brings in all of the different items that everybody's going to touch throughout the movie, and they line them up in the production office, and we all go around and choose what we like with the actors and with the director. And you can imagine when we were doing that for tennis rackets and tennis gear, it was like heaven for me because we were being really specific about, first of all, what the gear would say about the personality of the players, and also the status of the players in their lives, who had sponsorships, who didn't, what kind of brands were willing to have relationships with what kind of players. And also it's really specific to the time, which rackets were popular in 2006 versus 2019. What was is this guy using the newest gear, or is he using gear that he had 5 years ago because he had a sponsorship then and then lost it? So there was a lot of stuff like that, and a lot of very intense discussions about, for example, the character of Art, who's had a much more successful career than Patrick. If he's sponsored by Uniqlo and he's using Wilson rackets, is it too much like Federer, or is that good? Do we like that? There's a lot of that kind of nuanced conversation that was treated very seriously by a lot of people across many different departments.
I don't think that the movie, I can't remember anyone speaking loud mentioning, like, I don't think the name Federer is spoken loud in this movie, but there is some sort of scenery. There's, scenes in the Atlanta tournament where there's posters of actual Atlanta champions. You can see John Isner, Marty Fish, guys like that holding their Atlanta trophies in the background. Was that an easy sort of balance to strike of having it existing sort of in a real world with real people around it, but also insulating it in the same way from real names? Or, no one says, "Oh, back when I beat Nadal,"
Yeah,
in this movie.
it was something to navigate because you want enough of it that it feels grounded in deep culture and world that already exists, but not too much of it that it starts to make people ask questions about how these fictional people affected the alternate reality. It's kind of like in The West Wing, Richard Nixon exists, but Bill Clinton doesn't.
That's a good way to put it, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like they're living in the
Yeah, yeah.
country that had George Washington as its first president, but we don't necessarily want to get too close to the present, to the fictional present, or else it disturbs the balance of where this thing exists,
Right. There was some branch at some point that happened in the movie's universe, yeah.
Well, there has to be, because if Art Donaldson has six Grand Slams, who did he take them from? And you kind of don't, you want to cut those questions off at the pass so that people spend as little time as possible thinking about them.
Speaking of sort of questions, and this goes more for non-tennis fans, but how much did you feel like had to be explained, I guess, for people who, because this movie's obviously not just for tennis fanatics or people who know the rules of tennis at all, pretty much.
Yeah.
And this is something I've, writing a book. But I actually wrote a book about Naomi Osaka, so
Right,
going
I
on
know,
to
yeah.
off that U.S. Open final. Still, when I saw that, I was felt there's good synergy there. It's inspired a lot of stuff for a lot of people. But yeah, going out of that, like, how much did you feel like you had the movie had to explain, even things like the scoring system. I've seen some tennis, you know, programs like take pains to try to tell show viewers step by step how that works, or various rules or violations that get called. Like, how much was were you going to be sort of holding the viewer's hand through that? It seems like you guys kind of erred on the side of they'll figure it out, which I think works. But what was that sort of balance like of trying to get into some of the tennis weeds without losing people?
Yeah, I mean, I think I always try to err on the side of trusting the audience and respecting their intelligence, you know, and counting on them figuring it out. Because I think an audience can tell when you're trying to explain something to them very explicitly for story purposes, you know, and they start to feel like they're being given homework instead of being carried along through a story. So ideally, you want them to pick up the pieces that they need to along the way almost without realizing it. I think it was important to establish what a challenger is within the realm of professional tennis, because otherwise it wouldn't make sense why it was a surprising that somebody like Art would be playing one, you know, or why it was particularly smart, or depending on how you read it, challenging for Tashi to make him play one, you know, or to suggest that he plays one, and why it's sad that Patrick is only playing them, given the talent that he had as a junior. So I think a lot of that I felt a responsibility to explain to the audience, just so that they could understand the stakes of where these guys were in their lives and where Tashi is in her life. But I kind of knew that a lot of that would get to an audience through osmosis, through just looking at the thing, you know, through seeing the trophy that looks a little goofy, or seeing the setting of this match and seeing who's sitting there. And realizing that this is not the US Open, you know?
I mean,
Yeah.
Phil's Tire Town as the sponsor for the event, I think, kind of gets that, or whatever it was. Exactly, I got that right. Yeah, I mean, that
Yeah.
as a sponsor, it sounded very authentically challengery in a sort of
Good.
playful
Yeah.
way. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I
But it's still
mean,
like a night. But at the same time, it's not a dump either. I mean, it's a nice country club. The scenery's it's not a bad looking place either. But it's still not. Yeah,
well, that seemed to be the truth about challengers, that they're held in
definitely.
places that are nice enough and well-to-do enough that they have good conditioned tennis courts, but they're still sleepy enough that this low-level event would be something worth going to, you know?
Yeah.
And that felt really quaint and true and adorable to me, you know? Yeah.
How did you pick new? I knew because of all the tournaments, you go to a lot of real tournaments, or the players go to a lot of real tournaments in this movie, but the Challenger is not a real location for a Challenger. How did you end up picking New Rochelle as out of instead of the places? I don't know. I guess like Lexington is in that time of the calendar. There's a few other real places you could have gone. Not too
Yeah.
many, but a few.
Well, I knew I wanted it to be fictional just so that we could create the world of it ourselves and not have to be bogged down by, you know, the reality of a place like Cincinnati or Atlanta or any of the other sort of more prestigious tournaments that are included in the movie. I think I landed on New Rochelle because my survival job when I was a playwright and a novelist in New York was that I would tutor kids in Long Island for the SAT. I was working with this company that would send out all the new hires to the suburbs over the weekends to go tutor a bunch of kids. And I had a lot of clients in New Rochelle. And it just felt like exactly the kind of place where one of these things would be held.
Definitely,
Yeah.
definitely. That makes it. That, I think it works really well as a milieu for it. When you're watching all this tennis as a playwright, as a screenwriter now, as someone who obviously thinks cinematically or in these sorts of ways about presenting stuff, how do you think about the way that tennis is sort of shown to viewers? Do you think there's better ways, I guess, the tennis and the stories of it and the characters in it can be portrayed than how the job that the sport is currently doing with the real life characters and stories it has in front of it?
That's an interesting question. I mean, you know, I'm a big fan of tennis, and I, you know, when I was thinking about this movie, became a mega fan and a sort of obsessive fan, but I still very much think of myself as an outsider. So I would be very reluctant to say anything prescriptive about how tennis should represent itself. I think there is a gap in the way that tennis is broadcast versus the way it feels when you're watching it live that feels maybe more pronounced than the gap in other sports. But I don't know even if that's true. Basketball feels really different when you're watching it live than it does on television. But I think because it's a team sport, you can sort of get the dynamism of it a little bit easier. Whereas tennis, you're really spending the whole broadcast looking at a medium shot of two guys or two women. And then just by necessity, the broadcast ends up having to go to the same two overhead wide shots to communicate the whole breadth of the court, so that you don't miss anything, And often the way that the tennis will be shown in the replay is so much more dynamic than it is live. But it still works for me, like I still jump out of my seat watching tennis on TV. So it can't
You were
be.
watching the single camera challengers too. I mean, it was just the most, basic form possible.
Yeah, exactly. So, I don't know. I think, yeah, I mean, there's that David Foster Wallace thing about how watching tennis on television is like the difference between pornography and the warm embrace of another human. Like that's the gap. And I think that's true, but it's still pretty good. It's still what's happening on screen, what's happening on the court is still dynamic and exciting enough that it for me at least, it does jump through all of the barriers of the way it's represented to reach me. So yeah, I don't know. I think people, if they love tennis, should try as much as they can to go watch it in person because that is the best possible thing. And certainly making this movie, one of the deep joys of it was that we had real tennis pros or, really high level college players who were playing through the points in the movie so we could shot list it and getting to be like not just court level, but right on top of them as they were playing was like a deeply energizing experience because you just are watching these two people shoot bullets at each other,
Definitely. You mentioned the sex analogy, and this is a very, steamy, sexy, sweaty movie in a lot of ways, and allowed to be sexier than probably most mainstream tennis coverage would ever be allowed to be in certain ways. Or there's certainly fewer sauna scenes on ESPN, let's say. So how, I guess, in your Variety article, you said tennis is by its nature a very erotic sport, and added that usually playing someone of the same gender, so it's by its nature very homoerotic. And I'm wondering, how you sort of found that language of tennis. It's not something on this, in tennis journalism that I've talked about much, but I totally understand what you're saying, that give and take and that connection between the two people on the court. How rich did you sort of find that as a language? Because I think some of the most sort of, charged scenes in this movie are the tennis scenes, as more than the overtly, romantic love scene.
Well, I find tennis deeply erotically charged as a viewer because it's played between two people and they're completely alone on the court. And for the duration of however many hours it takes to play a match, they're completely obsessed with each other because they have to understand each other intimately so that they can trick each other, right? They have to get inside each other's heads and they're having a sort of conversation and a give and take on the court wordlessly for hours alone. And it's a bit like boxing, where it's a fight and you're trying to hurt the other person. But unlike boxing, which is all about contact, tennis is about the opposite. It's about avoiding contact. And so I find that within that, there is a deep well of repression, but also of violence and abandon. There's all these sort of very tight rules about movement within tennis. The point can't start unless the ball falls in exactly this little box, and your foot can't go over the line. And, you have to start with this particular very mechanized and formalized motion. And yet, once the ball is in play, this sort of wild chaos of physics takes over. And all of a sudden, all bets are off, right? And so I feel like tennis, just like a movie, is a container for the sort of chaos of desire. It's the chaos of two people who really, really want to win. And if they could, would do anything to win, you know? But they can't. They have to do it in this particular way. And so that, to me, the sort of mixture of strict, formalized rules around contact and engagement and all of that, mixed with the intensity of the desire, feels almost Victorian to me. You know, there's something incredibly charged about that. And so as a viewer, I just find a lot of eroticism in that. And I don't think I'm alone.
No, and that tension is there. Certainly, Victorian, you know, Wimbledon has all these rules about wearing all white and try to look sweatless and everything. But at the same time, it's these very physical athletes sweating and grunting. I mean, yeah, on the sort of, you know, eroticism or homoeroticism of tennis, there's it's basically two sweaty men grunting at each other for hours. And
Yes.
swinging wildly, and that makes sense. And that's again something people in the sport don't often touch. And you know, there's never been an openly gay tennis male tennis player of any ranking of any significance so
Yeah.
far in tennis history, which is sort of surprising given a lot of the following of the sport and the sort of the way that it could be open to that. So it's interesting seeing your movie engage with that, and you know, it could change some things. Maybe having this on screen as a possibility for people could maybe expand some horizons. A couple, two last questions if I can fit them in. Could this movie exist without tennis? Could you tell the story of these characters in a using a medium that wasn't the tennis world, do you think? Or do you think that tennis is really inextricable from the story in these characters here?
No, I don't think so, because tennis is very much the place where these characters can have a conversation with each other that they're not able to have in the rest of their lives. You know, there's a sort of communication or a sort of understanding that's unlocked through action on the tennis court with these three people who are so inexorably drawn into each other's lives and desires that I think it would be impossible for the movie to have the same meaning without tennis. And it would be impossible for these three to have their dynamic without the grounding in tennis, you know, without that being the thing that they share in common. So I think it's very much a movie about people trying to communicate with each other in a real deep way and only being able to do it in this way that is about movement and about the way you play. So no, tennis is completely inextricable from the plot or what's going on with these
Yeah.
people.
It was inspired by tennis, I guess, then. Yes, that makes sense that it would be
Yeah, it
deeply in
all
there.
came of a
Yeah.
piece. You know, there's no, yeah, it's not like I had an idea for a love triangle movie and then I put it onto tennis. It all came together.
Right. And then last thing, I think there's been a bunch of people for whom their favorite two movies from the past two consecutive years will have both come out of your household. And with your wife's movie, Past Lives. And you know, these are not probably the most obvious companion piece movies that people would think of without knowing that connection, but there are. I have a couple cinephile friends who, when they learned of your relationship, sort of both made similar points. They both are kind of these love triangle, to use that term, movies almost, or you know, a person picking between these two paths in life, or two men in front of them in terms of the woman. Have you sensed that as well? Had those conversations or thoughts about the sort of common grounds or common themes in these two fairly, again, not obviously similar movies, but they do have some sort of theme, echo in some way to each other.
Yeah, I mean, it's not lost on us that there are
Yeah.
movies about one woman and two men. I don't
Yeah.
know that it's accurate to describe Celine's movie as a love triangle movie, whereas I do
No, I
think,
wouldn't say so. Yeah.
yeah, whereas I do think Challengers is a love triangle movie. But no, I mean, you know, I'm like so incredibly proud of Celine, and I love her movie, and I think it's been just like the most spectacular thing in the world to watch this person who I love and care about and have known is a great artist for the, you know, however many years we've been together, that now other people are seeing that on this big scale. It's been insane. But I think in terms of the connection between the movies, you know, Plots between three characters are one of the sort of oldest and deepest plots in not just cinema, but literature. And the reason for that is that whenever the dynamic between two people changes, the dynamic between the other person changes too. So it's this naturally dynamic shape. You know, a triangle is always something that's a little menacing and a little has a lot of potential in it all the time. Even a perfectly equilateral triangle looks like a spear. It can cut you. And so I think people are drawn to triangles in storytelling because it's just this naturally dynamic and naturally sharp relationship, which is all about the angles between people, you know. But no, I'm very happy if anybody thinks about those two movies as being their favorites of the past 2 years. That's incredibly touching to me.
Well, thank you. Congratulations again on all your success and hers and everything you've gone with this. Hopefully, you can enjoy this this ride, and I'm sure people will be looking forward to what comes next from you. And I know you're working with Luca again on I believe on this on Queer, so that's great to hear. And yeah, congratulations. I'll let you go. I know you're a busy guy, popular guy right now.
Thank
So
you so much.
thank you
This
very
was
much.
really fun. And I've been a big fan of your work for a long time. So not to be pandering, but
No, pander away. It's
it's
fine.
very
Thank you.
as a tennis fan, it's very cool to be doing this. So thanks a lot.
Likewise. No worries. Thanks,
All right,
Justin.
peace.